Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is the podcast. Welcome to the show. Can I just reach out right here at the beginning to any of my listeners in the Chicago area? Look, I want to tape my special there. It's coming up this Saturday. I'm there for two shows. I'm at the Vic. Now, I know there's a threat of hockey. I'm taping this the day of the hockey game. I know there's a threat of hockey. I don't know how that will affect my attendance. I don't know how that will affect the city. There's concern amongst the powers that be that perhaps I should move my special. But I think I would like to prove them wrong. I think I would like all of you people in Chicago to come to my shows at the Vic if you could. You can go to WTFpod.com/calendar for the links to those shows and get tickets, please, Chicago. I want to take my special there. I don't want to have to move it a couple of months down the line because of a sporting event. Or because you guys had something better to do. This isn't a desperate plea. It's just I got it on the books and then someone, you know, worried me about hockey. You guys are going to know by the time you hear this whether hockey will be happening on this coming Saturday, the day of my special, whether the city of Chicago will be in shambles because of hockey, whether 90% of my fan base will just diminish that evening from my special taping to go to a hockey game. You'll know this Monday. And if there is no hockey on Saturday in Chicago, we are definitely doing the show. If there is hockey, there might be a question and you will hear from me. But as of right now, I'm coming. So get your tickets, Chicago and surrounding areas, please. What else? Haley Joel Osment is on the show today. And before that, my buddy Jerry Stahl will be in here. Talking about his new lease on life and his new book, OG Dad. Jerry Stahl, the author of Permanent Midnight and many other books. But I think you should check into all of Jerry Stahl's work. This is a great and miraculous turnaround in the life, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Jerry was also a writer on the television show Marin. I don't know if you're familiar with that show. The third episode aired just this last week. That was very emotional. Some people asked me if those emotions were real. The answer is yes, they were. They were real. And I got a lot of closure from processing that stuff in that form. And I think I'm getting a lot of feedback from people in marriages. Married people saying, dude, what, dude, a little too close. Cathartic. Didn't know how to feel. Helped out, maybe. Don't know. Good reviews. Very happy about the reaction to last week's episode, and more people are watching this season, which thrills me. But this upcoming episode, this week, this Thursday, Racegate, it's called. It's how can I give you a one-liner or two-liner pitch that doesn't give the show away? I decide that there's not enough black people, black guests, African-American guests on my podcast, so I go to a black comedy club to feel it out, seek out some guests, see what's going on. I book Bruce on the show, which wasn't easy in the episode. And then after he leaves with his small entourage, there's something missing from the house. So that's the inner struggle and the outer struggle of dealing with that. That's all I'm going to give you. I will tell you Dave Anthony is in the episode. I will tell you that. What the fuck do I need to talk about? You know, the great leveling is upon us. You realize that. The days of superheroes are coming to an end. You know, I saw a couple of tired superheroes in the last week or so. Bono, Mick Jagger. The day of the superhero. Everything will percolate now. Because of delivery systems and the way the the media is so fragmented and spread out, and the portals are so numerous. Everything's just going to percolate along at the same level, with a few kind of explosions here and there of people becoming transcendent, and then they'll just sort of drift quickly into the background as just another sort of like, oh, everybody got a real boost of adrenaline and excitement a few weeks ago from that thing, and a few people made a few billion dollars, but it's behind us now. When's the next thing on the percolating, leveled out playing field of everything is just okay? Am I speaking in too vague a way? What I'm saying is, because we're so wired in to a hyperspeed of consumerism, not much matters. Everyone's just feeding. Just feeding. Not sure any of that made sense. It seemed to make sense to me. Maybe you can make some sense of it. All right, so I'm very happy that my buddy Jerry stopped by. I'm always happy to talk to Jerry. I talk to Jerry a lot, but not on the mics. And it's an amazing story. Jerry Stahl, from a hopeless junkie to a hopeless Hep C sufferer to now a non-Hep C sufferer, completely healthy, new dad. Holy shit. It's a beautiful thing. So let's go to my conversation with Jerry.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Doll. How's your child? What are your tasks around the house with the baby?
First and foremost, try not to kill it.
Uh-huh. No dropping. Don't put it on the hot thing.
Again.
Yeah. No spilling things.
I try not to infect it. You know, we've often talked about not being the guy who walks into a room and just like depresses everybody for no apparent reason.
Yeah,
suddenly
yeah.
They're like, I don't know what happened.
Right.
I was happy a minute ago.
Yeah. Well, that guy's in here. Yeah.
God, the temperature just like.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the guy who infects my kid with like, you know, toddler depression. You know, I don't want to give her tot pression. So the alternate title,
but yeah.
So I just work on being that fucking. I'm the fun guy.
Yeah,
I'm just the fun guy.
I think it's done. I think, and knowing you personally, I think it's done wonders for your temperament in general.
Yeah,
I'm
much more tolerant of people who shit their pants.
Yeah. On the anywhere in life,
metaphorically, yeah. Physically.
So you could be sitting next to the guy, and the smell comes. You're just like, it's okay, buddy. Yeah, I got a baby.
I got a little thing right here.
Yeah.
Let me clean you up.
Oh, look at that. You just go into that the infant equipped restroom. Lay the guy on the little put him out.
Well,
little diaper bag with you.
Well, you know, I think the best investment since Pfizer came along with Viagra, the one stock tip I never took, because I never took one, but the one I ever got. But you know, boomers, if you see the ads for diapers now. There's hipster diapers.
No, come on.
Absolutely.
You're making it up.
No.
Really?
On my mother's grave. And you know how I feel about my mother.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't have to stop.
Really?
Don't have time to slow down.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. And they're all kind of cool, and they show like cool guys driving the cool car.
Why haven't I seen this?
Is
this on TV?
Oh, fuck it. Well, because I'm up at night.
It's like a Depends angle?
Yeah, it's Depends.
New Depends.
It's new Depends, and it Depends for you.
Yeah, with the Grateful Dead Steal Your Face logo on the diaper, or perhaps the Rolling Stones tongue, like the popular boomer musical groups.
That's what
groups.
I'm thinking. I think if you and I were investment entrepreneur types, more than what we are.
You can make the sexy adult diaper? Is
absolutely,
that what you're
absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Crotchless diaper. Come on.
It's for everybody, not just for those people anymore.
No, it's for us.
Well, a crotchless diaper, I think, would defeat the purpose.
No, it kind of would, but I'm just, for special occasions.
But maybe one with, with some lace. Oh, yeah. Come on. Why do people shit their pants?
because they can.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, is there, I guess that's because it's not all shit based. It's prostate.
I think it's mostly the,
prostate.
It's a lot of guys with dribbly prostate.
Oh,
tater
fuck.
Tots. Tater tots.
God damn it.
Well, you don't have to worry about that unsightly, like, you know, I mean, I've worn black for years. People think it's a statement. No. Yeah,
no.
I don't want the fucking drip.
You're dripping.
Come on. I don't know.
How long do you have to, like, shake your dick out after, like, I don't
know. That's the eternal question.
It is.
I see guys doing it for so long, I think they're masturbating. You
know? I know, but, like, I understand it now, because, you know.
But it doesn't matter how much you shake. There's always that one drop. Ah, shit.
Yeah, there's the stuff that's in the bladder. It's sort of like, no, I'm going to wait till he's all zipped up.
Well, you know,
out.
I blew my kidneys out back in Hep C days. They were doing double duty. So now, I mean, I go to the bathroom, then I either just turn around and go back, or I just walk to a different bathroom.
Oh, so, okay. So, but yeah, have you talked about that? This is like, to me, when people ask me about Jerry Stahl, as they will, because we work together. You wrote on my show this last season.
Yeah, high point. It was a high point for
They're
me.
Like, well, how's he doing? And I'm like, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but he seems great.
Don't fuck with my reputation. You're killing me, man.
Exactly. I'm like, you know, he's got this baby. He kicked the Hep C. It's fucking like he's like a new man. People like him. He's fun to have in a room.
That's crazy. I know. Well, I had that.
Does it bother you when I say that about you, though?
No, it's because it's the last frontier. I mean, you know, I had that grim revelation when I got cured, like, geez, man, you've like spent your entire adult life either strung out or ill.
Right.
Or dying.
Well,
basically.
Most of the time that I knew you when we did another thing together and you were just sweaty and dying all the time.
Yeah,
and like,
I
you
know. Not a lot of
horrible,
fun to be around. Yeah.
Horrible medicine. Well, that was, I think, a lot of it. I mean, do you even remember, were you ever this free of that shit?
Like, never.
You
know,
free of
never.
The dope, free of dope and free of sickness.
No, never.
Wild.
Never. At the ripe age of 113, I've like emerged as like, hey,
I'm okay.
I don't feel like shit. I thought feeling like that was the human condition, was just feeling like warmed over shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think that has a lot to do with that thing you were talking about before, the sort of like being heavy in the room or being.
Yeah, the guy who's just a drag.
Well, because you didn't feel well. And you were like,
I didn't, you want to rise above and just suck it up. But, you know, I wasn't suck upable.
So this is like, to me, this is amazing because like I think I talked to you about, writing. A book, but you know, obviously you did your angle and you did it before I brought it up. Jerry Stahl, this is OG Dad, the new collection of essays. But like, I thought maybe there was this outside chance that you would actually become like almost a spiritual Buddha-like parent that saw life completely differently now that you have a baby. But no.
You're saying I'm not?
Maybe you are. Are you?
On the inside. See, I think that guy...
How do we get that out?
Well, I think that guy would really depress the room.
Come on, we expected worse out of you, Jerry.
The Buddha again.
Yeah, here we go. The wise one.
You know, easy lotus boy.
But because you have a daughter who's in her 20s.
26, yeah.
That you were absent a bit during her childhood.
Well, let's just say I was a dope fiend, and then possibly even worse, I was a celebrity dope fiend. So I was the guy at birthday parties, like the parents would herd their children into a different room.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah.
Don't get any of him on you, either psychically or otherwise.
I heard him on Oprah. He's creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she had to grow up with that.
Yes, she did.
Now, with
riding buses. I was living in a garage, not to brag. I mean, it was
riding buses to visit you.
Yeah. I would pick her. You know, I showed up miraculously, but you know, not that was necessarily a good thing.
Oh, you took a bus to
I took a, or I, we would go to my garage on a bus and I would take her back. It was just like, oh, no knock on bus riders, but it's LA. So, you know, it ain't a prestige gig.
Now, are you aware, are you sort of showing this one attention with a vengeance?
Well, I'm in the house, so there's that.
Right.
You know, I was kind of living at the corner of crack and eight ball. You know? So I wasn't doing a lot of dad. I don't think I ever, you know, sadly really put my first child to bed or any of that stuff. You know?
Yeah,
so,
oh, really? No recollection of that.
I don't recall it because I don't think I did it.
Right.
But there's a lot I just didn't recall anything to screaming. I just wasn't there. I thought I was like kind of a good dad, considering that I had a, like a bazillion dollar a day dope habit and stole fives out of her mom's purse every time I visited. I mean, I told you that story where, like, you know, that poor her mother, like, got busted. You know, it's like somebody was using your ATM card.
Oh, really?
And I was that guy. I was like, oh, that's fucking awful.
Yeah.
And then they go to the bank and they have, like, the tape. And it's me. You.
Like, Do you recognize that guy? Oh, shit.
My doppelganger. At it again.
But do you, like, I don't know what it's like to have a kid because I don't have one, but I have to assume you feel like with the baby, you're a little more clear in terms of the type of love you feel. Do you feel that love for the kid?
Yeah. I mean, it's the great thing about a kid. I mean, you know, I love her. It's great. And it kind of makes me weirdly happy because it's so unambiguous.
Yeah.
You know, you love them unconditionally and you will disappoint them. There's like no...
But why do you got to think of that second part now?
Because it happens every day. On some level, they're like, I hate you. You know,
how old is she?
She's three.
Already she hates you?
Well, temporarily. All right. You know, just she's my kid. I mean, come on. Right. She's got the jeans.
Yeah. She's walking around wearing black.
Only because she doesn't want people to see her drip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's not a fashion
thing. Given her the gift of self-awareness and insecurity.
That is the worst. You know, seeing like the fashionista babies, you just want to fucking throw up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't love other parents. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do have to go back to like the daycare where like when my first child was little, I kind of like did a little too much heroin and passed out in the bathroom when they found me.
Uh-huh. In the daycare.
I have to walk by that little bathroom every day. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's the same daycare?
It's the same place. Stop it. I've like fully boomeranged.
So you're back in daycare.
Yeah. They're like back. Oh, this guy's still alive as a kid?
You made it.
Fuck.
And how's your older kid take to the new kid?
You know, she's really taken to her.
Now.
But, I mean, initially, of course. I mean, who wouldn't be like, nice, you're showing up for her?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. But she's a very cool kid. I mean, in spite of having me as a father, she's a happy, well-adjusted,
and I think the good thing,
kid and very beautiful.
Your first daughter.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like, it seems to me that you made the right genetic decision with the current wife.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this one.
There were probably a couple. Wouldn't have been a good idea. I mean, we're just going to leave it at that.
This one.
No names, please.
Right.
I mean, we know each other's history.
Sure, yeah. This one looks like she comes from good stock.
She, Finnish, Irish, you know.
Oh, good. That should erase the junkie Jew right out of this kid.
Oh, my God. This kid, forget it. Yeah.
It's got a shot. She's got a shot.
Yeah. She'll spend a lot of time in saunas, but that's it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think she has a shot.
And
but you never know. I mean, the world is so grotesque now that, you know, roads are melting in India and every kid in America is getting blastoma from their parents leaving, you know, the cell phone near the head of the bed. So I'm like,
is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I can't, like,
it's not so horrible.
I'm not up to speed on my topics of worry. You know, there's something about being selfish and detached from the current events and the news where it's sort of like, oh, geez, there's a lot of things I should be feeling shitty about.
Nah, I mean, the thing about us, we're going to be well out of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just picture her like grubbing for cancer scraps, you know, when there's no water in 2030. It's going to be fucking horrible.
Is that when it's supposed to run out of water?
Oh, we'll run out of water before then, but the cancer scraps kick in.
Earlier?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Christ. What is it? Let's not talk about that. So let's talk about the beauty of the kid. What's her name?
Nico.
What? Now, the process of writing this book, this was a series of essays you were writing?
This is a series of columns, a.k.a. blogs, as the kids say, in The Rumpus and with a bunch of new ones.
And it started when the kid was born or when she was pregnant?
In utero. For like, we were in Texas. We had to go to have the baby in Texas because, as you know, I got on this medication. Which, as soon as I got on it, this experimental drug at Cedars, the first thing they said was, oh, and by the way, if a pregnant woman so much as, like, gets a drop of your sweat on her epidermis, the kid will be born with, like, you know, flippers and a three-day beard.
Yeah.
So, you know, mom had to go to Texas to be away from me.
Oh.
And so when I was cured, you know, I finally go there, and we do, like, the OBGYN stuff in Texas. And they had like never seen a Jew. They're like, we're in the waiting room. They're like, Mr. Stale, do you have the Jew panel? Because there's diseases only Jew. You know, it's like Tay-Sachs and it's like creepy Jew diseases.
Right. Yeah.
They're horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody turns around. I'm like, they're going to fucking, you
yeah.
know.
You didn't have Tay-Sachs, did you? The Tay-Sachs gene?
I think I would be dead.
Yeah.
I don't think you live too long.
I don't know how. I think that's from incestuous. The Orthodox get it, right?
No, man. I think maybe they do.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
I have no, you know, you can offend Orthodox all day long.
I try not to.
I hide my payas.
Yeah.
I wear them on the inside, if you know what I'm saying.
Your hair's curling on the inside.
Everything's curling on the inside.
So it started in. You know what's weird is when I've told Siri to call you, she does the full pronunciation German. She goes, calling Jerry Stahl.
Nice.
Siri does that. Stahl.
Stahlwerks. Yeah. You know, in German, it means steel.
Does it? As in S-T-E-E-L?
In America, yes. That would be S-T-E-E-L.
Not S-T-E-A-L.
Nice pun, but I didn't. I was working my way up to stealing. I was more of a like, just shove it under my shirt and run.
So this is the big release for Father's Day.
Huge release. Yeah. It's gonna
come on,
be.
OG dad. It's like, this is, I think eventually, you know, I don't know if it's in this particular book, but there will come a time where you will shed all of the darkness.
Absolutely.
And just become a pure light.
You don't think I'm there yet?
No, I don't know what it would be like to hang around with you like that. I don't know. Generally, people who claim to be that are intolerable.
But I feel the same way about you. I mean, you've become a much lighter guy.
I've definitely known you
for a long time.
Yeah.
We were not a bunch of like fun dudes. I mean, we were great for each other.
Yeah.
We could one down each other all fucking night long.
Yeah.
You know?
No, right. I think when we both met, we were like, I was definitely aggravated and angry and not well in my mind, and you were sweaty and sick.
And perfectly well in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I actually learned, like, there's a way that you kind of when you are listening or something, like I took some trick from you when I interview, actually.
I remember talking about this, yeah.
Did I talk to you about it on the mics?
No, not at all, no.
No, there
I'm
was
trying
just,
to remember what it was.
Well, there's just a way that you kind of like almost, you have a boundary or something. When you listen, you just sort of have this gaze that's sort of flat.
It's a kind of detachment, but paying attention at the same time.
Right, right. There's a detachment to it, but you're engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that you did it. And like I learned how to do it during interviews. I think it's like you're receiving, but you're not. You can't be read as judgment, and it can't be read as like, you know, it's passive
in a way,
but engaged.
Well, I'll tell you where that started. You know, I did journalism for most of my like the 20s and 30s. It was pre-internet, so now it only exists in my storage bin.
Right.
But I was so fucked up that I couldn't really, you know, keep a, you know, I just would stare at people with like, I'd kind of do the forehead, you know, the concerned puppy wrinkles, the concerned wrinkles, and just kind of nod once. And people take that as vast concentration on the fascinating things.
But you were just trying
saying.
Not to nod off?
I was just trying like not to go away visibly.
That's where that came from?
Well, then ultimately, I don't know if you've learned this interviewing, but everybody has a story.
Mm.
And when they get to the end of their tape, whatever that thing is, if you just shut the fuck up, there'll be like an awkward, horrific pause, and then they get to the real shit.
Right.
Have you found that? Like everybody
usually
has
it's right when I turn the mics off. When it happens for me.
Yeah, like that's when shit gets real.
Yeah, an hour and 15 minutes, I'll turn the mic off, and then it's like, yeah, my dad shot somebody. I'm like, wait, can I just... Did you not want to say that on air?
Jeez, yeah, I know that about. I've seen that happen. Yeah,
and sometimes I'll ask if we can get it back on.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever say, could you just like repeat what you just said, and then you hit the mic again?
Well, I will start talking about something like after I turn the mics off, and then I'll be like, did you not... I think we should talk about this on the air. Do you want... And if they go, yeah, and I'll just turn it back on and figure out a way to reset it. You know, I don't generally let them go through the whole story. I'm like, this seems like something we should be talking about.
Yeah, I've done that. Yeah.
I've turned it back on. And then sometimes people are like, no, I don't want to talk about that.
It's like, great. That's the most interesting thing about you.
Exactly. I hate that more than anything.
That is the worst. There are so many, you know, there's so many people who do that.
Yeah, just sort of like.
Are we off the record now? Let me tell you.
The truth.
Yeah. And you're like, what the fuck did you just do for an hour and a half?
Exactly.
I got to write this thing
and
now,
I gotta know
and you've been bullshitting me for an hour and a half,
right,
asshole.
And I got to know in my heart and my mind that we were skirting around this. This is what we were dodging.
It's just kind of insulting to you as an interviewer on some level.
Yeah, but what are you going to do about that?
Nothing.
I mean, it doesn't usually
give them the gaze of acceptance,
right? And it doesn't usually mean that what you have is a lie,
no,
but it's avoiding.
It's also less interesting than the truth.
That's right. But people also know it when they hear it. They
know
when people are dodging you know, but I can't do that, you know, setting the person up like, after we were done with this interview, she told me the truth about what happened. And this is sort of, I guess, a great example of someone dodging the truth. Enjoy.
Because she told me about the thing with her dad.
Right.
Listen,
yeah. But not.
See, I can't tell you.
See if you can feel the heat of it.
Yeah.
When she's talking about ice cream in the middle.
Listen in between the words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, people do. I think that's the nature of the medium.
Yeah, but I mean, like you and Terry Gross, I mean, you got some amazing shit out of her. You have such a great gift for that.
Well, it's funny because but I also knew like when she wasn't like, it's like, I knew when she was not going to go somewhere, you know,
because you were very gracious, but
yeah.
You also didn't let her slide.
No, I didn't. I couldn't.
The first husband? Come the fuck on. Yeah. Who knew?
Yeah. That guy. She was concerned. She's like, I hope he didn't. And it's like, no, he didn't throw him under the bus.
Not at all. She didn't throw anybody under the bus.
No, she didn't.
But I don't know if you have. I have this thing where I've done interviews over the years with like, I'm sort of already the leper because I'm like the junkie weirdo guy who has confessed every heinous thing.
Right.
So people talk to you because I'm like outside the herd.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, people.
And you are very honest about your emotional.
I get that
trauma.
Too, but not because
so
of the same. Yeah. Well, I know that, like, I don't know what it is because it's not quite the same because people also know that I do have a public forum I talk out loud for a living.
Right. As opposed to a guy who just retreats into a corner.
Right. Yeah. Right. The dark holder of secrets. Jerry Stahl. Yeah. It's a business card. Dark holder of secrets.
AKA the vault.
Yeah. The vault. I think that people. Because I'm upfront about my own personal struggle, I think that enables people to think that.
Hell yeah! Because nobody else is doing that, really.
Right. Right. But that's a lot of pressure, isn't it? To be like the guy that is sought out to be the confessor, and then you're sort of limited to the box. It's like,
well, it is. On one level, it's pressure. You could also say, if you want to be an enlightened asshole, that it's a privilege.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do know a lot of shit about a lot of people that I will take to the grave.
Right.
What else are you going to do?
Well, that's what I always wonder about that. And the same with what I do is that I don't socialize a lot. I mean, you and I have a good time. We hang out. We'll get something to eat. We'll have some laughs.
Yeah, you're kind of my best friend.
Right.
How often do we even see each other?
Right. Exactly. It's like, you know, when you're these guys, when you're the guy that talks about himself all the time, or you're the holder of secrets, or like, I'm not going to invite him. Because... Cause he's just going to be standing there knowing all that shit about me, and I don't want to be reminded of it.
Makes me really uncomfortable,
exactly.
Quite honestly.
Right.
I actually don't like him.
Yeah, I like him.
I kind of resent what he knows now.
About me.
Because there is that. There's that thing where people like kind of turn on you because they know you know.
Or you
they
assume
know you
they
know.
Do. They do
That's
know you
true.
Know.
Good point. I could be projecting.
Yeah, I mean, usually we are, but there is evidence that like I'm not invited that often. Do you know, like, I don't hang out with a lot of
people. See, in your case, I would argue that that's because people think you're famous, you're successful. He's probably busy.
I'm at home, you know, just looking in my refrigerator 9 times, 10 times.
Sure.
Snacking a lot. And then, like, I finally got to a level of anxiety where I had no choice but to polish my boots.
Nice.
Yeah, polish the boots. Did 3 or 4 loads of laundry. One of them wasn't even necessary.
We should have just done the interview while that was happening.
Oh.
That would have been great.
But then I think, like, why don't I go out and why don't I give so-and-so a call? And then it gets hard to fill in that blank. Why don't I give a call? I don't know. Who am I going to call? You know, where I could just sit here. I mean, I call you and we talk, but you know, you're busy. But I'm just saying, like, what am I going to do?
Yeah, I'm busy doing my laundry.
Right.
Yeah.
So then I drive around and, you know, I go shopping and I'll go say hi to somebody at this. I go to the record store to say hi to that guy. I'm no different socially.
Yeah, I know all the checkers at Gelson's a little too well.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. I've, you know, I'm better with strangers, you know?
Absolutely.
All right. So we're just loners by virtue of our gifts.
And that's
it.
And nothing makes for a better dad than like a creepy loner. You know?
Yeah, but you're home at least.
I am home. I'm home now.
Is the kid talking?
Sure.
Really?
Blue streak. Yeah.
Like, what's she saying?
She's lying a lot.
At 3?
Yeah. Oh my God. It's like, is this the junkie gene kicking in? It's like, yeah, mommy said I could like take the chocolate and just pretty much eat it all.
Really? Already?
Like, really? I don't think that happened.
That's what she knows what she wants?
Oh my God, the deceit.
Really?
Holy shit.
Do you laugh? Is it funny to you?
I engage. I say, really? When did she say that? Really? And okay, well, and go ahead, I guess.
good parenting. Yeah. If mommy said, if you're telling me the truth.
You know what? If you're lying, it's a good lie.
Yeah. You got me. You convinced me.
It's really fascinating, man. The level of dishonesty and manipulation. It's
to get what
fantastic.
They want. Fantastic. To get what they want.
Yeah, yeah. Because when they're a little young, she was a little younger. She just turned 3 last week. It was tears.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like traumatic public screaming.
Right.
And can I just say that screaming in public,
that'll get
when you look like me and you have a little kid, it's like, they're not going to take my side.
Yeah. What did you do to her?
Yeah. Beast. Oh, we're just calling, Amber Alert.
Yeah.
But now it's all about fucking lies and manipulation. It's beautiful.
Ugh.
She's really good at it.
Well, it's sort of interesting that's the instinct that you have to teach. That's something you have to teach them not to do.
Yes,
of course. Get their needs met by any means necessary.
I mean, I shouldn't be rewarding her?
Giving her the chocolate.
Well, there's so many. I mean, I haven't read a lot of books about parenting.
Why should you?
It creeps me out.
Wing it. Go with your instincts.
But I mean, you never read how fucking boring it is sometimes.
Yeah.
Or the truly disturbing thing. And, this could get us, but this is a reality of life.
Yeah.
Both my daughters came out of the room.
Yeah.
And the womb, basically. Let's just say touching themselves.
Yeah.
Let's just leave it at that.
Right.
And you don't see that on the Chicken Soup for the Baby books.
No, the sort of weird compulsive masturbatory habits
of toddlers. Yeah.
I've heard that. I mean, I think boys do it too. I know I had a cousin that was, very attached to the banister once she figured out how to manage that.
I've got like the Ethel Merman laugh.
That's good.
Today.
No, you don't.
I don't
it's
know
good.
Why. But
rubbing up against things.
Oh yeah.
It's look, why wouldn't you? I mean,
somebody tells you to stop, what the hell? At what age is the cutoff where you can't just reach in your pants? I remember when
I'm doing it now. No one ever told me that. I try not to do it in public. Sure. I'm not doing it now when I'm talking to you.
Well, I see the table stops right about chest level. So I don't know.
That's my key to doing a good interview. I just got my hand on my dick the whole time.
He got really excited for a minute and then he just kind of petered. But I know when we first put her in diapers, she was like, what? I'm like tapping it. Like, what the hell? Who shut the door?
Oh, that's hilarious. Like, why is there an obstacle
here? What's going on? Like, why would you do that to me? It's my one pleasure.
Oh, that's hilarious. So she's a lying chronic masturbator at 3.
The masturbating is low. That's gone.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, but not as much. I mean, I think she likes to hold her for security.
Right.
As who doesn't?
Yeah, yeah.
But, it's not. I think when you're a baby, it's like, what else? You have no other. Nothing else, shitting and touching yourself.
No, you're going to have to figure that stuff out. So now, would you say that this book, OG Dad, is an effective baby's book? So would this be helpful to parents?
Absolutely. much to my surprise, and I didn't know the publisher was going to do this, if you turn the book over, it lists it as parenting.
Does it really?
And I kind of had a shit fit about that, but then I thought, you know what?
It is.
I know.
Parenting.
I thought memoir, humor, essays.
I think this might be the right place for it.
Yeah. Because I am the guy.
If they pick it up for the wrong reason, that would be surprising.
Yeah. Why is he always talking about heroin? I don't understand.
It's a very, very specific parenting experience.
And yet universal. It's also, it's just, this was a... It's weird shit happens when you don't die young. I mean, I didn't expect to be rolling back into dadhood, but what the hell?
But Dad.
You just call me Dad?
Almost. Wow. But
knowing your dad, that's quite an ambiguous honor.
I tell you honestly, I've never seen you happier and more clear in the eyes. Skin looks good.
Thank you.
You seem relaxed. You spent a whole season writing for my show. You were in a room with other people every day.
I know.
And we had a good time.
My first staff gig ever.
And you were nervous about that originally. You're like, no.
Well, I think not as nervous as you. I mean, come on, be honest, motherfucker.
Well, no, I was like, no, I think he's doing.
I think he's okay.
He's better with other people now. I swear to God, he's not the same. Guy from a year ago.
Only a year ago. It's so true. I look at my life and just the parade of embarrassing gigs and weird shit that happened.
Because of your own discomfort, though.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, projecting it and suffering and
flicking. We had a good time. Everybody respected you and you did a great job and we had fun.
Well, you got a smart bunch of guys in there. I mean, come on, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun when no one has anything to contribute and we're just waiting for something to break and there's just like 7 guys in a room.
Tweeting.
Yeah, tweeting, looking at their mail and then finally I go, what are we doing?
What the fuck?
What the fuck is happening?
Every fucking week it's like this.
And I stand up and I start, what are we going to do with this beat right here?
And I hate this gum.
Yeah, yeah. Shit. That's writing. That's staff writing.
I was really blown away by the fact that I had spent my entire life avoiding people. I think I became a novelist, not because I have any fucking talent.
Yeah.
What else can you do? Like naked and alone at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So being in with you guys was like, wow,
yeah,
this is actually kind of great.
And here you are, I guess, to bring it full circle, is that you're 60,
mm-hmm,
and there's a new lease on life. You have a new infant child. And you, you know, begrudgingly are feeling better about things. And this book is the result of that.
And a functioning liver, which makes it all possible.
Does it now? Do you regenerate that? Does like now?
My virus was wiped out.
No, I get that. But do liver cells regenerate? Like, is your liver growing now? Does that happen with a liver?
I can hardly sit down. It's so big.
Or whatever. Does it get? Like, whatever damage was done, does that regenerate, I guess is what I'm asking.
I think it's probably still got the consistency of an old shoe, maybe a little scarred, yeah, but you know what? It's
working.
I'm not spending all my energy fighting off death.
Right. Like, you have color, man. You have color in your face.
I really appreciate that, man.
It's fucking great. And I'm happy about the book, and I'm happy for everything that's going on, man.
Well, I'm happy we're still here kind of being friends. I mean,
we're better friends now than we ever have been. We have some good laughs, buddy.
We do, yeah.
All right, Jerry, thanks, man.
Thank you, man.
Jerry, the book is OG Dad. But you should look into all, you should read a lot of Jerry's books. Jerry is a powerful prose man. A prose master. The guy puts a lot into it, man. A lot of punch in the prose. Let his punchy prose punch you in the head. Right in the brain. So now, Haley Joel Osment, who's in the Entourage movie, which comes out on June 3rd. I hear he's very good in it. I've heard that. But you know, Haley from The Sixth Sense, I'm slowly stroking out. I'm slowly incapacitated mouth-wise. But he was also in Forrest Gump. And Pay It Forward was a big one. AI, artificial intelligence, a big Haley Joel Osment movie. Oh, my God. Oh, my fucking God. He was a kid actor. You're always wondering how those kid actors turn out. Well, this kid is very level-headed. Nice guy. Let's talk to Haley Joel Osment. I'm only saying it like that because I have problems with L's. Haley Joel Osment. Now. How are you, man?
Good, man. How you doing?
So you're doing the one-ear thing.
Yeah, I don't know why. I've always done that.
That's a professional trick.
Is it?
Where'd you first see the one-ear cans move?
It just came naturally to me. I've recorded this video game series since I was like 10 or 11. And
yeah.
I always just like to hear myself a little in the room.
Yeah. So that was just a natural adaptation.
Yeah, it just felt right.
You were like, I can do this in here.
Yeah.
So the last time I saw you was on a rooftop in Hollywood.
That's right.
What was that for again?
A pre-Emmy party, and I was there, I believe, for The Spoils of Babylon. And actually, Billy Bob was there, too. We just finished Entourage.
Did you know you were doing Entourage when you saw him at that thing?
We were right in the middle of it.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
He's an odd fella.
You know, I didn't know what to expect going to work with him, and he's just the funniest, coolest guy, and also a great musician.
Yeah.
And one thing that
he's got a rock band.
He does, yeah.
I got to get him in here.
Yeah.
I think he gave me his phone number, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he would be a fascinating interview. He's had such a cool career.
Yeah, Well, I mean, he's just a guy. He's sort of in his own time zone, that guy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You get around him, and you're like, well, this is another planet here.
It's it was nice because like I play his son in the movie and like he has such a distinctive voice. Like that's I like had to have this like kind of thick accent for the movie and like
what
starting
accent?
Was his. We're Texans in the movie. We're, you know, got a Glock on the hip and you know, horses and cowboy boots and everything. And he's from Arkansas originally, and that was a fun voice to come
from.
Well,
you grew up in this. You're from, your family's from the South. Are you Southern?
I was born out here, but my parents moved out. They were both born in Birmingham, Alabama, and they moved out here in 1985.
That's real South.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they talk like Southerners?
I can hear it a little bit with my mom, but since they, it's been now exactly 30 years since they moved out here. My dad, I can't really hear it at all anymore. But it's a, you know, from family and everything, it's a very familiar accent. Although Alabama isn't even, you know, thicker accent in a way than Texas.
Yeah, there's some pretty wide. I mean, how did so Halle Joel Osment?
Yeah,
that's the real name.
Yeah, that is.
And do you, that sounds like some Southern history to that name.
I guess maybe it's a. You know, we're Irish Catholic from the South, so a lot of like saints names, a lot of Michaels and Patricks and everything. And my parents pulled both my sister and my names out of just a book. Just wanted to put something fun together. So yeah,
just a book.
Yeah.
What's your sister's name?
Emily Jordan Osment.
Well, she got like she got an easier go of it.
I guess, you know, Jordan's kind of unusual.
Yeah, it is. Emily Hallie's odd.
I have never met another guy with that as his first name. You know, a lot of girls, but very few people who actually have it spelled the same name too. Haley Duckel from the Dirty Projectors was spelled
Haley.
The same.
Is that is that what you say?
Yeah,
Haley, I keep saying Hallie.
Yeah, that's fine too.
No, it's not.
They didn't know how to. Nobody knows how Edmund Halley's name was actually pronounced. So.
Is it Haley?
Haley, yeah.
So Haley's the way to go.
Haley's the way to go.
But you don't correct people.
Nah, you know.
It's so I have to correct people when they spell my name wrong. So did you have family down there? I mean, did you travel to the South much?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, we were out there at least every summer.
In Birmingham.
In Birmingham, yeah.
It's like the more I go back to the South, the more I fucking love it.
Yeah. And Birmingham particularly is a city that's having you know, a lot of stuff going on in the downtown area, a lot of good food things going on there.
Well, they're every little city now is like reinventing itself.
Yeah.
With restaurants. The Food Network has changed the entire culture of America. Every fucking city of any size has their chef guy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Has their good restaurant. Their quote unquote good restaurant.
Yeah. Artisanal. I was in Asheville shooting a movie a year and a half ago, and they were like, this is our locally produced wine. I was like, from the mountains of North Carolina.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I was just there.
Yeah. Asheville's a cool town.
It is. I didn't, you know, I was only there for like, you know, a day, and I didn't really get around.
Yeah.
But it seems to be just this weird little kind of old style hippie art town.
It is.
That actually has a longer history back than the hippies. But it just seems to be a kind of progressive little haven in the middle of I assume a pretty red state.
Yeah. De Niro's father actually painted at a commune, or not a commune, but he lived and painted near Asheville.
Really?
For many years, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Those Blue Ridge Mountains are pretty, man.
Oh, yeah.
I never drove through there before. That was gorgeous.
Yeah. That whole region. We were shooting a movie that had a lot to do with like Civil War history in Appalachia.
What movie was that?
A film called The World Made Straight, which came out a couple of years ago. Months ago.
And how'd that do? Where'd that go? What happened to that movie?
I believe we were well reviewed, but it was just a small release. We had Jeremy Irvine in it, who's great, and Noah Wiley and Minka Kelly, and Steve Earle, which was really neat to have him.
I know Steve Earle.
Yeah. He's great.
He's all right.
Yeah.
He's made some good records, that guy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Was that the last movie you made?
No, we actually shot that a while ago. I just finished a movie in the fall called Sleepwalker. And that has Richard Armitage and Anna O'Reilly, and that'll be coming out later in the summer.
What is that about?
I play a kind of a nasty stalker type character who's sort of after this girl, the lead.
What is this new Haley Joel Osment heavies?
I know, man.
What's happening?
Yeah, it's fun. I think growing the beard helped. I don't know what I originally did that for. I think it was for the first season of Spoils of Babylon. And I think the last time I saw you, I probably had like a pretty long, big beard.
Yeah. Beard going.
Yeah. So that's
But you were like you were like the wonder kid.
Yeah.
You're the gifted one.
Yeah.
And now you're like you're playing heavies.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun not being the you know, moral center of the movie.
You want to be the moral left of center of the movie.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Well, I mean, how did that happen? I mean, so you were born in L.A. Was your folks in show business?
My dad moved to L.A. to work at a theater called Theater 3 on Santa Monica Boulevard, mm-hmm. and he ended up being the general manager of that theater in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, but my involvement in it was just sort of by accident. My mom was shopping at IKEA in Burbank one day, and they had one of those things where they had two casting assistants taking Polaroids of every kid that walked in.
Really?
And yeah, and my...
you say that like that's a regular thing.
It used to be. I don't think they do commercials like that anymore. And I remember going to these cattle call auditions as a kid where you'd have like 1,000 people there.
They were just scouting, or they were literally...
Looking for kids for commercials.
For IKEA.
Yeah. No, it was for Pizza Hut, but they were next to the like kids area of IKEA. You know,
just like weird predator, like they were... predatory casting agents.
No, it was nice, like young assistants. You know, I remember it was like nice.
But they were scouting at IKEA.
And next to like the ball pit, you know, where kids congregate. Yeah.
Okay. So
I think that's why they sent two women instead of two guys to go.
Yeah.
To
so it's not fucking creepy.
Yeah.
Sure, you're a casting agent.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
So, all right. So you're just minding your business, and they come out of nowhere and go, "That's the kid."
I guess so. It would two very immediate strokes of luck was that one where I was part of this Bigfoot Pizza thing for what was ultimately a terrible pizza promotion. They had the Bigfoot Pizza, which is this terrible thin crust pizza. But the casting agent for Forrest Gump saw it.
You were unhappy with your first role.
I remember. I was.
As
at least
pizza
the product.
Pitch man.
Yeah, yeah.
Disappointed with what you got behind.
But then it led to the casting agent for Forrest Gump seeing it, and I came in and read with them, and then read with Hanks, and then that was my first project.
Casting agent for Forrest Gump sees your shitty pizza commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Does he take you to task for the pizza? Does he say that was not good pizza?
She did not. She did not.
She was like, that kid's got something.
And yeah.
So you how old?
Four.
Four?
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
I know. Yeah.
So you read with Tom Hanks at four.
Yeah.
Do you have any recollection of that?
A very, very clear memory
really?
Of that. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess you would sort of have to.
Well, it's
in a way.
With that whole experience, like one of the clearest memories of that shoot was I learned to tie my shoes on the steps outside our Holiday Inn hotel room in Beaufort, South Carolina, where we were shooting the Gump House stuff.
Oh,
you know,
That was who taught you?
Yeah, my dad. My dad.
Oh, he was there on set with you the whole time.
I think I'm giving credit to the right parent. But both my mom and dad came.
If that upsets them, then you have bigger problems. How dare you say that your father? I just made up a voice for your mom. Can't be right.
Yeah.
Can't be right. All right, so that shoots where? So that was in South Carolina?
They shot all over the country, but my stuff was in Savannah and Beaufort, South Carolina.
At the big house.
At the big house, yeah.
With that, who was the woman that played your mom?
Robin Wright.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is crazy.
So, all right, so you remember learning how to tie your shoes and reading with Tom Hanks, but do you have memories of the set? Do you have memories of doing that work?
Absolutely. The first day I was there, it rained a lot while we were down there, and I believe it was the production got delayed a lot. And it rained so much that we opened the door to the trailer after like 3 hours of downpour, and the area where they had base camp had flooded to like knee level on an adult, so the PAs were in waders carrying me above this swamp water to get to the set. And one of the first things we shot was the final scene on the bench where he opens a book and the feather goes off and everything. And Zemeckis and Hanks rewrote the scene a little bit on the last day, minutes before we shot it.
Right.
And Hanks got this yellow legal pad and wrote out the new dialogue and my lines on it. We actually saved it, and I still have this little thing, you know, Hanks handwritten sides for me. So that was
he was a nice guy to you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you guys ever talk?
I saw him a couple years ago. It was a while ago now, but I went and spoke at his AFI Lifetime Achievement thing. But yeah, he's a great guy.
I always assume that everybody keeps in touch, and it's a ridiculous assumption.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big movie to do out of the gate.
Yeah.
And then what happens? You do like a bunch of kids' movies?
No, I actually did a network television after that. I was on a show with Ed Asner called Thunder Alley.
Ed Asner.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
He's a funny, cranky man.
Yeah, yeah, he was terrific.
So you did you did a shitload of those.
Yeah, did that, and then Foxworthy Show, and then finally Murphy Brown, the last season of Murphy Brown. So I did like those three series kind of in a row.
But Thunder Alley and Foxworthy Show, you did a lot of eps.
Yeah,
episodes.
Two seasons each, I believe.
And did they not last longer than that, basically?
I think both were canceled after two seasons.
That was it for that.
Yeah.
But you did a lot of little roles. So you were just a working kid actor.
Yeah.
Before you became like the boy wizard in that one movie.
Almost.
So now when you're doing that, how were you? Because I've only talked to a couple of you guys. You freaks. Yeah. You freaks of nature. You children actor people.
Yeah.
I talked to Seth Green.
And you talked to Amber Tamblyn, I believe, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you are the most prolific of the youngsters who did that as a child. And you were, I think, you know, a great actor. I think you still are.
Thank you.
I don't think you lose that. Did you train at all, or did you just have this natural weird gift?
Well, my dad studied theater in college, and he had a great theater professor there named Dr. Oliver Link, who studied at Cornell.
Where'd your dad go to college?
What was then West Georgia College, and now is, I believe, West Georgia, University.
Yeah.
Became university. But yeah, they just did you know, Godot, Runner Stumble, sure. You know, Three Penny Opera, everything.
Yeah.
And so he had this great foundation in theater studies and theater acting. And so even from a young age, it was going through the script and you know, character study and rehearsal and stuff like that. So it was a really good sort of foundation.
You did that with your dad?
Yeah, you know. And as a younger kid, it wasn't quite so much going through and finding the beats and everything. But
right.
as I got older, and certainly by the time of The Sixth Sense, it was, you know, we would be, you know, going through the script, you know, taking notes and all
that
stuff.
So he was your coach?
Yeah. And it was a really cool, you know, creative experience to do that.
So he would help you make choices?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think probably the best encapsulation of that would be when I was, we first got the script for The Sixth Sense, you know, and it's a scary movie and all this stuff. And we were talking about it, and he's like, you know, this movie isn't so much about, you know, being a horror movie as much as it is. It's the people trying to communicate with each other and how frightening it is when you can't get across to somebody else.
Right.
And he's like, oh yeah, that's, you know, thinking about it in that sense made it a little bit deeper than things popping out and scaring you.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was always sort of there to do that? Like crack the character with you?
Yeah. Up through high school. Yeah. And because they're, you know, number one, there's really strict laws about your parents always have to be on set with you and everything.
Right.
And I was very lucky to have someone who actually had studied acting and, you know, could be, you know,
and
helpful
you,
in that
do
way.
You feel like he was living his dream through you a bit?
No, I think he, you know, he certainly was happy to, you know, have this happen for his kids. And he had, you know, he has his own career. He ran that theater in...
Yeah, but he's not a movie star.
I mean, that's there's pluses and minuses with being in movies. You know?
Yeah.
Because I went and studied theater in college, you know, and was doing, you know, a play in Philadelphia as recently as 2011 when, you know, my wonderful management and agent were like, can you please come back to Los Angeles and audition out here and do that stuff?
Let's talk about that. Did your father, was he always supportive, or did he warn you of the possible pitfalls of hanging your hope and life on show business?
Well, that was definitely the thing from the beginning, is that especially when I was a little kid, was if you don't like doing this, you can quit tomorrow. And even with those credits and everything, one thing that's funny to remember now is that those movies you do like 6 to 8 weeks, and then I was in regular school the whole
time.
Right,
then you had a life.
So my primary memories of this is regular, you know, elementary school, regular elementary school and regular high school and all of that. But yeah, both my parents, I think, especially when The Sixth Sense sort of changed everything, were concerned about, you know, me being able to have privacy, being able to, you know, maintain that kind of, you know, keeping my feet on the ground. And going to college, that always being the end goal, was something that I think really solidified that.
So through all this, you were in your mind saving for college in a way.
That was the first thing I ever spent any money on. Yeah, you know.
But you put a lot of money away.
Yeah, well, that's the law here. It's the Coogan Law. So your money all goes into a trust fund until you turn 18.
The Coogan Law.
Yeah.
Jackie Coogan?
Jackie Coogan, yeah.
Oh, so your parents can't touch it?
Nobody
can touch it, yeah. So that's to protect you.
It is, yeah.
From your parents, basically.
If necessary, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's too much. And what did your mom do?
She was and still is a sixth grade teacher.
Here in town?
Here in town, yeah. Yeah, in Montrose.
I think that's that's not too far from here, right?
No, not too far. 20 minutes away.
That's about the last year that it's probably a fun thing to do, to be a teacher.
It gets more and more challenging every year, just because now with smartphones and stuff, there's a lot more
holding attention.
Kids get, well, you know, if you know, that's really, I think she has described it as like it's kind of the last age where you can really you know, connect with the kid before things get kind of solidified in middle school and in high school. And yeah, it's a really, really tough job.
Yeah.
And they, you know, there's, you know, they don't always have class size regulations and things like that. So she can have, you know, up to 40, 42 kids in the class at one time,
which is
chaos at that age.
That's crazy, but she still chooses to do it.
She loves it. Yeah, she taught in Alabama. She taught kindergarten and first grade briefly at one point, but sixth grade is usually the age she goes for.
All right, so the big movies were, for you, were the Sixth Sense, Pay It Forward, and AI.
Yeah.
Those were the big ones.
Those were probably, probably the most widely seen, yeah.
And you played different variations of a sort of slightly disturbing child.
in different ways. Yeah, right. One wasn't a child at all, I guess, by some measure.
What, but, AI?
AI was, that was pretty different, but... Maybe disturbing, but
No. I mean, I don't mean disturbing. Just emotionally, sort of, painfully aware and troubled, but intense. I think is the word.
Sure,
intense.
Yeah.
And that we're just naturally like that.
I mean, it really comes from the material, because this, you know, when The Sixth Sense came about, I was also doing a half-hour network comedy at the time, and then you get a script like that, and it's like, oh, you know, it's a lot to think about, and particularly. I remember the first time reading the script for AI, which was a very, very, very powerful script. And I was 12 when I first read that. And that was really a script I remember where you're like, oh, I got to think about things in that context, though. Because it's an epic that sort of encapsulates the entire end of humanity and everything, and, which is a lot to think about.
But, it is. Yeah. Generally, on any day, that's a lot to
especially
think about.
Especially now. Yeah.
So you're 12 when you first see that?
Yeah, when I first read that.
So when you sit down with your father... What was the conversation around that?
That one, I don't remember talking so much about the overall, you know, philosophy of that movie or whatever. What we worked a lot with on that one was that there's a big specificity to every movement that he makes. And there's
that great first scene
when he comes in and he's close on the shoes. And that whole first act of the movie, which is, you know, so expertly done by Steven, is all about those little specific things as he sort of grows into this sense of humanity. And I just remember, you know, going at home practicing the toe taps and the movement of the head and everything, and the not blinking, which became a, you know, sort of a thing that we kept going for the whole movie. So,
oh, really? No blinking.
He never blinks until he closes his eyes at the end. Yeah.
How did you fucking do that? I guess a take is a take. How long is it
practice,
take?
But it was, you know, really, it's like, yeah, takes in movies aren't that long,
right? So you're not, you know, the initial thought is like, how do you keep your eyes
and
the
hiding
whole
it from when you turn away from the camera or something like that, a whole bunch of stuff. But actually, I was just doing a music video for John Wayne where I'm lip syncing underwater, and I was like, oh, I remember this, because in AI we were underwater and not blinking, and in this music video I have to kind of do that.
Yeah, that was an eerie shot. Now, Spielberg, working with Spielberg, when you're entering into that, it must be sort of like, oh my God. What was the audition process for AI?
We just met for that one. Cause
he had you in mind?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. So we just met and talked about it in very vague terms, because we didn't get the completed script for a while, because there's a lot of secrecy around that one.
Mm-hmm.
But
that was originally a Kubrick script, right?
Well,
That was Minority Report. Was it AI? It was AI.
Kubrick was involved. He and Spielberg had known each other for a while, and Kubrick came to him and said, I think this is closer to your sensibility. Let's make this I believe this is the quote, a Stanley Kubrick production of a Steven Spielberg film. So Steven was always going to be the director for it.
And Stanley died.
Right before we got started. Yeah. Uh-huh. And an additional, you know, bit of tragedy with that is that according to Christiane Kubrick, I've heard her say that he was sort of getting fed up as being thought of as this recluse and this kind of eccentric guy. And, was planning on maybe doing a little bit of press, maybe coming to America, maybe starting a new chapter in his relationship with the rest of the world, which I think is a sad thing to have missed out on, if that was the case.
Yeah, yeah. Or not. I mean, maybe we all want to keep him sort of
secluded. In that mysterious...
Yeah, yeah.
Did you see the exhibit they had 2 summers ago?
Yes, I did.
Oh, my God.
At LACMA?
That was incredible.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then have you seen that weird documentary about The Shining? Of all the people?
Yes, yeah.
What is it called? Room 137?
Room 237. Yeah, really.
That's
enjoyed that.
Crazy.
Yeah. There's a great essay in Harper's, I think it's Jay Roach, I apologize to get the author wrong, where he's talking about reviewing that film and some like traumatic memories from his childhood. And he says The Shining becomes this movie that is just this expanding black hole that absorbs all context until everything is just referencing this one. You know, I'm doing the quote hard, but I kind of like, I love thinking about the movie in that way, is that it's so large that, you know, and it's so expertly done in, you know, informal terms that it can just absorb anything you want to put into it, even this crazy
theories.
Oh, I see
what you're saying. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's so precise in a way. And so, but leaving enough, that movie really fucked with my head.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of them are just nuts, but one of them was sort of like, man, it is kind of weird.
Yeah.
How intentional was that?
Yeah. And there's the thing is that when you're so good at choosing the people to collaborate with, and you're so good with those technical things that
even accidents
sort of start to be, because there's the first time you see a flash of the two little girls in blue and the blood coming out of the elevator.
Right.
The music that's playing, I didn't think about this till very recently. The music that's playing is the Penderecki piece, The Awakening of Jacob, which is the story in the Bible where he, you know, has the dream where he sees the angels moving up and down the ladder, and it's God's promise of good things on earth.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, the two girls, maybe those are the two angels, and instead of a ladder to heaven, Kubrick's is an elevator of blood coming up from hell.
From hell.
Which is just like, but so, I don't know if that's the intention. And he had a music supervisor. I don't know if he chose that piece of music.
Well, that's the interesting thing about those coincidences is that, you know, was Kubrick, someone said, I think in that movie, that he was operating on so many levels of genius, you know, that like he was playing chess on three different levels.
Yeah.
You know, that he had that kind of brain.
Yeah.
But still, it seemed like an awful lot to manage. And maybe it was just serendipitous that he was so in sync with his people who were making decisions. But like around that Calumet flour, the sugar, whatever it was, the Indian.
Oh, the Indian? Yeah. Or just that the hotel doesn't make any physical sense. Have you ever seen they talk about in the documentary.
Yeah.
Where nothing fit. The gold room doesn't fit.
Right.
Everything is changing all the time. Extras in the first scene when people are checking out of the hotel are walking into, you know, blank walls and things.
Right.
It's just absolutely insane.
How,
He had a map of the hedge maze because they really built it. And, and they said that the crew would get it, and then Stanley would come in on the weekend and change it, so people would walk in and get lost, and they'd just hear his booming laugh from over way in the maze. So someone who
trippy,
got that
man.
Enjoyment of trapping
I'm just sort of fascinated with the idea, you know, with set deck in general and how things work out. I guess if everyone's operating at the best of their ability and they're all gifted people, you're going to get something amazing. How'd you know that about that song?
I am a big fan of Radiohead and Johnny Greenwood, who does some classical compositions. Uh-huh. I don't know if you could strictly call it classical. He does a lot of stuff. He was a big fan of Krzysztof Penderecki. And then
who is Krzysztof Penderecki?
He was an avant-garde, I believe he's maybe still alive, an avant-garde Polish composer.
Okay.
Does very dissonant, I don't know music theory, but it's a very specific, it's, you know, related to like Ligeti and all of those other composers,
and
the
20th
century composers
right.
that he did. Yeah.
So he's one of those guys that's sort of not a noise guy, but a trippy guy.
It can sound really, you know, dissonant and everything. Uh-huh. The moon bus in 2001, that really eerie choral thing that's going on. But
so you dig that music.
I really do.
But you also know that Bible story.
Yes. At the time I was reading I think it's in this one, Harold Bloom's The Shadow of a Great Rock,
uh-huh.
where he's going through the Bible and the Torah and you know, talking about it in an aesthetic context. Yeah.
Just in an aesthetic
context? Now, he's taking out any sort of religious things and just
you
talking
mean,
about
literature?
The presumed authors of, there's like the J writer and this trying to trace the sort of clues into who may have written various portions of the Torah and the Bible.
Right. So
and then comparing that to like the King James book and the choices that people made in translation.
What'd
like,
you learn?
A lot. I haven't finished that one yet, but talking about the committee of men that put together the King James Bible was just a fascinating group of people who, you know, just had to make these decisions. And one thing that sticks out is he calls Harold Bloom. He says that there's the terse, coiled energies of Hebrew that had to be translated into English rhythms and everything.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a great book.
Oh, he's a good writer. That
he
guy.
Is. Yeah. Yeah.
He's a literary critic.
Yes. Yeah.
So I've not read much of him. I've read a little. I've slowed down on my reading in general.
It's hard these days.
Right?
When I wake up and I spend 20 minutes on Twitter and I'm like, oh man.
What the hell happened?
I just got started with that a couple months ago.
I got the attention span of a child.
Yeah.
But what kind of religion were you brought up with?
We, our whole family going back is Irish Catholic.
Are you 100% Irish?
A little bit of German and a little bit of English, I believe.
Were you practicing Catholics?
The family was. Yeah.
And so you went to the whole church business?
Did the
here in LA. Catholic church in LA.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. My parents are married in Birmingham, but yeah.
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 But I mean, so you went to church as a kid.
We did, yeah.
Made time for that.
We did.
Yeah. Along with school and shooting movies.
It was, yeah, busy schedule.
Yeah. Do they still go?
Yeah, they do. Oh. Yeah. We all go at Christmas and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, at Christmas. Yeah. Oh, the big day. The Easter. Nice one.
Yeah, the big ones.
Yeah. So you're brought up with the Catholic faith, which is a very ornate and...
it is, yeah.
Lyrical.
Yeah.
Is that the word I want?
Sure.
Elaborate. Elaborate.
There's a lot of pageantry.
Yes, that's right. Do you you still practice, kind of?
Me, not so much, no. Yeah. But
let it drift.
It's kind of the thing. It's like having that cultural identification.
Sure,
nice,
yeah, I know. As a Jew, we have that as well.
Yeah.
So getting back to Steven Spielberg. So as a director, how'd he handle you?
He's extraordinary, you know, and someone who to this day will send a note on birthdays and graduation.
Really?
And to someone who's, you know, a digital Rolodex must run into the hundreds of thousands. He really keeps up with people and is, just really cool that way.
Yeah. How did he direct you? What was like, you know, it seemed like you were putting a lot of work into your physicality and you're making decisions with him around the not blinking and stuff.
Yeah. I just remember, one of the great luxuries of working on a movie like that is that we went to his home, me and Jude and Francis O'Connor, and were able to rehearse for days with him. And I remember him having me and Jude walk around his pool in the Hamptons because Jude had done extensive like kabuki and ballet and all like months of dancing lessons for his because he played a male prostitute robot. And so he went, you know, they were trying to find a good thing because my character walks in a certain way and Jude walks in a certain way. And we had their electronic teddy bear.
Yeah.
We all wanted us having a kind of almost Wizard of Ozian kind of
thing. Did somebody bring that
together.
Up?
No, that just came to me now.
Oh, Wizard of Ozian.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was thinking that. Did no one brought that up on set, huh?
No.
It's kind of funny, though.
Maybe. It's a long time ago. I don't want to take credit for it.
No, Spielberg is his own genius.
Yeah.
Well, how did that show itself when you were working with him? What was the moment where you're like, oh God, this guy's...
We were working simultaneously on, I believe, 4 sound stages and had a significant portion of the Warner lot sealed off for us.
Uh-huh.
And on the call sheet, just hundreds of crew members. And he was able to walk from set to set, doing work here, a little bit of work here, a little bit of work with me, a little bit of groundbreaking work with CGI, with ILM, and to do it with a very even-keeled, calm manner. It was crazy to watch.
Really?
And also would be someone who, like, Al Gore would call. This was during the election in 2000. Right. You know, Mr. Spielberg, the vice president's on the phone sort of thing. So.
Tell him to wait.
Yeah. And he also, you know, he works with a lot of the same crew and the same ADs and wonderful producers, and Kathleen Kennedy produced that one.
Right.
And it's just a really great thing to be a part of.
So Night Shyamalan, what do you think happened to that guy?
Oh, he's been very successful. I just saw him recently, and he's been doing.
This is a question you've been asked before. One.
No, I really enjoyed his movies, and particularly Unbreakable. I think is really
I love Unbreakable.
Yeah,
but that was before yours, wasn't it?
No, that was after.
Oh, it was right after.
Yeah, it was sort of a very dark superhero movie years before that became a big thing.
Right.
Yeah, he was 5 years ahead of, you know,
and
that
was
stuff.
Bruce Willis, too.
That was Bruce Willis as well, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
How did you like working with Bruce?
I loved it. Yeah, he was great.
Is he a pretty, solid dude?
He was, yeah. A lot of fun.
Does he send you a birthday card?
He did. We got some. We went to Japan together for the press tour. And just a really, really cool guy.
Now, when did... Yeah. Okay, so working with Spacey, too, that must have been sort of an education somehow.
That was really cool, yeah.
Because he seems to be a very disciplined, kind of interesting actor.
Yeah, very, very poised. Yeah, a lot of screen presence with that guy. Yeah, he's really amazing. And I see him from time to time, too.
Yeah?
He and the family really got along really well. So.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And,
Helen, too.
Now, when did your parents stop going to sets with you? What movie was that?
Because when I did Secondhand Lions with Michael Caine and Robert Duvall, that was when I was 14, we shot that. And then I went into high school really intensively.
Duvall, those two guys are heavy.
Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, and we just had like 56 days at this one like ranch in Texas, just the three of us most of the time. And that was really
did
special.
Did you get any wisdom from those two?
Well, yeah, both of them. And Caine's stories were about acting, but also, I mean, he fought in the Korean War. You know, he's telling stories about meeting up at some midway point before he went to Korea with the British Army and meeting American GIs on the way to Vietnam and they're going,
really?
Like, where are you going? Korea, where's that? Where are you going? Vietnam, I don't know.
Yeah.
And seeing, I remember, if I'm remembering correctly, he's talking about seeing human wave attacks from unarmed Chinese soldiers and stuff. So a crazy, crazy life.
Right.
But, and with Duvall, I don't think I've ever met someone who is so protective of the other actors and protective of the process, in that we had a scene where he's in a nightgown in a freezing lake. We're shooting it late at night. We shot his stuff first so he could be dry and get out of the lake. And they turned around on me and brought him his coat. He goes, no, I'm going out there, and did his off-camera stuff. 75 years old, standing in freezing water just for my off-camera stuff. So,
and that's commitment.
Yeah.
Respect.
And you just see like a tradition of that, of, you know, someone who has been protecting the actor's process for, you know, decades.
Oh, yeah. I love that guy.
Yeah.
And then after that, you say you just walked into school for a while?
Yeah. Applying to college is crazy.
Right.
So with, you know, a lot of like APs and, you know, the sort of extracurricular stuff at school that you need to build your college resume. Basically sophomore, junior, and senior year of high school, I was just there the whole time. And then by then I was 18, and since then it's just been me on the road.
Yeah, but the plan was to go to college.
Always, yeah.
And to study acting.
Well, that actually wasn't sure of. I applied to a variety of schools, and it took until the college trip on the East Coast and just going to NYU and going to the building where I ultimately go to school for 5 years. I just had this feeling there of, oh, this is where I want to be.
You went to NYU?
I did, yeah. Yeah, so it's and the visit there was a lot of really beautiful campuses, visited a lot of cool schools, but NYU's building was like, oh, there's work happening here.
Right.
And the guy giving the presentation was about to go run off and, you know, run some production or something. It was
What was
nice.
The program you were in over there?
The Experimental Theater Wing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, generally speaking, comes from the theater work of Jerzy Grotowski, who's another great Polish artist.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
And what does that work and require?
What was nice is that at Tisch, there's a lot of studios, and, you know, one is the Stellar Adler studio, one is the Meisner studio, there was a Strasberg studio, all under those
All within NYU?
Yeah, and the musical theater and all sorts of stuff. And at ETW, there was, I think, the greatest available variety for stuff. So we did like Afro-Haitian dance and Anne Bogart stuff and Mary Overly's Viewpoints.
Wait, I don't know what any of that is.
It's a lot of like Mary Overly is this great minimalist theater artist, and she had created these six sort of stems with which you could evaluate and describe and choreograph minimalist physical work, you know, among other things. And that fed into self-scripting, where we would just have like a 4-hour class in the afternoon, and you'd either start with a movement or a situation or just a power unbalance between two actors or something, and find this nugget of an idea, and then have, you know, quickly spin it out into something else, you know.
So this is like antithetical to Hollywood.
Yes, yeah, and that's why they place you in,
I mean, this is barely usable. I just mean, like, you know, when that this is an esoteric theater, like art, you know, like experimental theater is obviously it exists and it should exist and it's great sometimes, but when it's not, it's horrendous.
That's the risk. Yeah.
So what were these other things? The Bogart technique. What were the other things you mentioned?
Well, with Grotowski, who was probably
the
the biggest influence. Yeah. A lot of our professors had studied with him in France in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And his stuff is difficult to put into words sometimes, but one thing would be like plastique. So you'd have these very specific repetitive physical movements that are done in an exercise, and then, you know, there's, you know, emotionality comes into it, and you might have a scene that you're working on with a partner, but it sort of can detour off into these physical movements and everything. And we're doing a lot of contact improv. We had people who'd been involved with the Judson Church dance community, which is some really forward thinking choreography and stuff. So yeah, just a really, really fun environment to be around.
But like, what did you think you were going to sort of pursue out of that?
It's funny to remember now is that I just knew that going to college would be important, and to study with people my own age, which I hadn't had the opportunity to do a lot when I was doing
as an actor.
Yeah, as an actor, and I was going to see how it was, and I, you know, I wasn't sure if I would be staying. And great things about NYU is that they were very accommodating to allowing me to go off and do work You know, I did an independent film in 2008, although as soon as I did that and this play on Broadway, I had so many credits to make up. I was like, I'm just going to stay and finish everything.
What'd you do on Broadway?
American Buffalo, the Mammoth play. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that before. Yeah, I've seen that play. Done.
Duvall, I think, was in the original production.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, he played Teach.
He did, yeah.
So that makes sense.
Yeah.
And who was that Pacino?
I believe so. In the original
performance.
He might have been the L.A.
I saw Pacino do it in Boston.
Yeah.
And
nice.
And it was a revival already.
Yeah.
I wonder who originated. So how long did you run with that?
We only ran like a month.
Didn't catch on.
We did not get good reviews. It needed to be a little bit tighter. You know, because
you played the junkie. Who played Teach?
John Leguizamo.
Really?
Yeah.
And who played the other guy?
Cedric the Entertainer.
So that's a clown show.
No,
there.
It was you know.
Cedric's great.
He is.
Well, John's okay, but I just mean like, you know, there's a lot of ways you can play that.
It is, and the main thing is that it needs to at least be tight, and we had a really short rehearsal schedule, and after we got bad reviews, we started knocking 10 minutes off the running time and started to actually pick up and everything, but it just, you know, it needed to be a little bit tighter when it came out.
So, yeah. Okay, so you now when you go out into the world and you're doing this stuff, are people like, that is a kid from The Thing?
Sometimes, yeah, that's the, you know, it's the double-edged sword of being in a film like that, is that you become so strongly identified with it. But I also am lucky enough to where it was so long ago that you get older, and you know, now you were just, you know, talking earlier about playing, you know, the heavy, the bad guy, and
right.
And
but it's weird, yeah. Like you know, this. Well, I mean, it's not quite like Macaulay Culkin, but your face and the idea. There's something about making an impact as a child actor that people just can't seem to forget.
It takes a while.
So I imagine that people look at you and they're just sort of like, oh, he's in there. That kid's in there still. I see him in there.
Perhaps.
But was that challenging for you to, like, on an ego level? I mean, obviously, it seems to me that going to NYU kind of buffered the transition.
Yeah.
But was there, like, sort of, did you feel it? Like, did you feel like... Like, did work slow down at all, or did you?
I mean, I didn't appear in a lot of things between 2007 and, like, 2012. There was, like, a 4 or 5 year period, but it was nice because it was, you know, I was very busy in those years on that stuff.
Right.
And it's, you know, I just, I didn't have any really concrete expectations of, you know, what the career would be like. Just I wanted to be in a position to continue to make different work. And I always wanted to make work of my own, which we had the opportunity to do at ETW and develop stuff that I want to, with now. I wrote and directed a play for my final project in my final year, which is an idea that I maybe, you know, turn into something else, hopefully soon. But yeah, just, you know, and normally,
you
like,
can't
I always
talk about it.
Not yet, because I'm hopefully going to be coming out with it soon when we're through Entourage and all that stuff.
To do a movie?
Series, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Because when I was in college, I was still, you know, writing something, would be thinking of a screenplay or a movie, and now this is just such a fertile time for series. And, you know, having watched all these shows now, thinking of ideas as something that can unfold over a number of years, you know, is kind of
appealing. You
got
to wait a year for the next season now,
right?
With some things.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I didn't know that Mad Men still had some closure to do.
Yeah,
it was like, didn't that end?
Yeah. Oh yeah, because they do the half season, like
with
Breaking
Bad. Yeah, it was like the last one. I was like, how long ago was that?
I know.
Okay, so you're gonna do that.
Yeah.
And that was born out of your experimental theater years.
It was certainly shaped by it. I'd always wanted to write things, but it changed just in the process. Like when I would, you know, write a screenplay or something when I was younger.
Yeah.
It would be, you'd have an idea for a story and you have the beginning, middle, and end, and you try and write through that. And with ETW, we would just come up with these, like, you just have a strong character or an idea or something, kind of loose, and sort of work outwards from the middle and out where that character has a home. And that, to me, in the writing process, is really suited, you know, a series idea for things that where you may not know what the end point is yet, but you're starting.
And
you've
built this character for this series out of improvisations and experimental
theater? Yes, they began with you know, some of them did, yeah.
And like, have you directed before? I mean, have you done any directing, film directing or anything?
No, would love to do that. But just that one thing in college is the only thing I've directed, but would love to do it again, yeah.
So in a way, you're kind of like, this is a whole new start to your career. You're still like a young guy.
Yeah.
How old are you?
27.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you've been in movies for, you know, decades.
It's crazy. It's nuts, man.
Now, are you married?
No, not married. No, uh-huh. I got a girlfriend right now, but not married, no.
And how's it like? Yeah. Didn't you get in some trouble a little while ago?
About 10 years ago, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
does that still hang on you? Do people say?
No, people have been good about it, you know, and it was a terrible mistake, you know, wrapped my car around something. But yeah, it was like 10 years ago, and it shouldn't take a lesson like that, but
of course it should.
Lesson learned, yeah.
Were you in a situation where you were out of control at that time?
No, it was just a bad night? High school recklessness. You know?
Oh, it's high
and
school.
It's, yeah, and it's just, you know, this is LA, and, you know, you're driving from place to place and shouldn't have been driving, you know. Yeah.
So, and what do you do, like, on a, what are your day-to-day sort of shit that you do now that you're just doing promo for a movie now?
Yeah.
What's your life look like?
Writing out here. It's harder for me, and it's so stupid, but, like, I prefer to live in New York. I still have a place out there.
You do?
Yeah, and I just fell in love with that city, and weirdly, a lot of the people I grew up with that I was friends with in high school are also on the East Coast now, so it's odd coming back and working in LA, and it's like, oh, all
so
the
you
people
spend most
here,
of your time in New York?
When I can, yeah. I was there for about 7 years completely, you know, almost.
You just bought an apartment over there?
Yeah, yeah.
And still got it. That's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So I love working there. But this season, been writing in this early part of 2015, been writing in LA. We just did the second season to The Spoils of Babylon, which was
on IFC, on the network online.
Yeah, we're channel brothers.
Yeah.
That's with Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig and Michael K. Williams and Maya Rudolph.
And everybody wrote on it?
No, it's Andrew Steele and Matt Piedmont wrote it.
Yes, Andrew Steele from SNL, right?
Yeah, they both were on SNL. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you host SNL?
No, I have not.
Oh,
no.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would thought that they'd been, yeah, that you would have done it when you were a kid.
Maybe. I'm kind of glad I didn't do this again.
Yeah? You think it would have fucked you up?
No, it's just like, that's a huge honor. I'd love to do it with the brain of an adult, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You seem to be appearing in movies that I don't know. What happened to Sex Ed?
That had a release and I believe should be streaming pretty soon.
Yeah?
Yeah, we had a great cast. We have Matt Walsh and Retta. And Lorenzo Izzo, very funny.
Yeah. And what's the other movie? Where'd you shoot in Asheville?
In Charlotte, which is not quite as interesting in Asheville, doing Tusk last year.
What is Tusk?
It's the Kevin Smith movie with...
oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, about the podcast. There's a podcast.
That's right. Yeah, it is podcasty one.
And how was that? How was working with Kevin?
He's great. We all got along so well that the whole cast came back for a second movie that we just finished in the fall, Yoga Hosers, which is Johnny's back for that, and
yeah.
Justin and Genesis and everybody. So, yeah.
What is that about?
I play a Canadian Nazi in one part of the story, a real character named Adrian Arcand.
Yeah.
He's this nasty guy in Quebec in the 30s who was a Hitler admirer. And then,
so this is based on fact?
Yeah, my character is based on it's a heightened version of a real horrible guy that was, actually lived in Canada. And then the rest of the movie is, can't give too much away, but it's kind of a spinoff of Tusk in that there are two characters who appear very briefly in Tusk, and then this movie is sort of what's happening to them while the Tusk storyline is happening.
And, like, are your folks still around?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was saw my dad today. My mom's still teaching just
well,
over
no,
there.
Yeah, we talked about that, but your dad's still, what's he doing?
Absolutely.
For
he and I work on houses. He worked in construction. He built the Santa Monica, he was a foreman on the Santa Monica Pier Arcade and the Japanese American Museum.
This after the
this
theater?
Was in the 90s, yeah, after the equity wars and the theater shut down. So yeah, he's
so you do you work on houses?
He remodels houses, yeah, and he
what does
he's
he flip
a great designer. Not flip them, but does remodeling work and stuff like that.
And you do that with him?
No, we invest in things together. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you're not like so people who hire him to do their house, they don't come home and say like,
not me.
Isn't that Hallie Joel Osment working?
No, he's not doing construction, but he does the design and stuff like that. So yeah.
For remodels and whatnot?
For stuff like that. Yeah, he's always been really good with that stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do you do for hobby, buddy?
I am a big sports fan. Been seeing almost every Dodger home game this year, which has been fun. And then I'm also geeking out on your guitars because I play music just to entertain myself as well.
You keep busy.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
Do you do any athletics yourself?
Yeah, I love mountain biking around here.
Yeah.
Play a little golf, play a little tennis. So,
golf?
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
That's the naturally goes with the business.
But I mean, have you been playing a long time?
Yeah, since I was a kid. Yeah, because you go on location in, you know, Texas or something like that. It's a fun thing to do on the weekend.
No one's ever taken me golfing.
Let's go.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll go with you.
Do you love it?
Yeah, I do. I really love it.
What's the appeal? Explain to me, because people have such an amazingly deep relationship with golf.
It's hard to explain because it's very frustrating, but that's also the thing that... there's like a zen quality to it where
I keep hearing that.
It's a good way to just, because the movement is so complex and the only way to accomplish it is to not think about it while you're doing it.
Right.
And just developing the feel for something as weird as that sport, and then whenever you succeed or you ever get it where you're supposed to go, it's an amazing feeling. And it's nice being outside. Yeah.
It's nice being outside and it's quiet.
Yeah.
And you're just walking or slowly driving hole to hole.
Yeah.
So it's the whole sort of...
My friend I worked on Alpha House with, she just told me she went to Versailles. And did you know that at Versailles you can drive golf carts around drinking rosé?
Alpha House, what's that?
It's this show with John Goodman that we did 2 seasons of on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
So,
that's right.
Yeah, but the golf cart made me think about it because I never pictured Versailles as a place where people are driving little cars around.
Well, I mean, you got to see the ground somehow.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah. Have you spent time in Europe?
Yes, I have. Yeah. And I did not do our summer program with ETW, but I did visit our studio there when a lot of my friends were training there over the summer. In Amsterdam, that's where our summer program is. So.
For NYU?
Yeah, for the, ETW. Yeah.
What does that stand for again?
Experimental Theater Wing, yeah.
So this is a crew that you work with. Have any of the people you went to college with, are they sort of like doing amazing things in experimental theater?
It's been, yes, definitely. One of my friends was hired immediately by Cirque du Soleil, and I've seen him in Vegas a couple times. So, and then also, my friend Sarah Sutherland is on Veep right now playing Julia Louis-Dreyfus's daughter. My friend,
I saw her. Yeah,
she's fantastic. And then
she was at school with you.
Yeah, she was in my class, my small group of 12 people for all 4 years. And then Alex Anfanger, who was 2 years ahead of me, his show Big Time on Hollywood, Florida, is on Comedy Central now. So it's crazy because everybody's coming out here and you're seeing
those. Don't
pop
sound
up.
Very experimental to me.
Yeah, but they have a series. He and Dan Shimp have this thing that I did an episode of called Next Time on Lonnie. That I think is a very specific sort of comedy that comes out of the kind of stuff that they did.
Right, right.
They have been influenced in some way. I can't speak to their process, but they have a really distinct voice, and I think that our program may have contributed to that.
So, in terms of the Entourage movie, were you on the TV series as well?
No, I wasn't.
So it was just a casting.
Just auditioned. Yeah.
Isn't Constance Zimmer, is she in that?
Yes, she is. She's fantastic.
Yeah, she played. She did an episode of my show this year.
Cool.
Yeah, she's great.
We were just in DC with the Creative Coalition a couple weeks ago.
What is that?
We were lobbying members of Congress for NEA funding for the arts and for education.
Really?
Yeah. You know, really, really cool experience.
Who else went out there for that?
Tim Daly was there, and Gabourey Sidibe, and my sister, and like about a dozen people came, and we broke into small groups and went and met with Boehner's staff and McConnell's staff, and then some more people who were friendlier to our cause. Congressman Dan Kildee from Michigan was there, and I was paired up.
Did you meet Boehner?
No, he was not there. He sent a staff member, but they were all very nice, and I was actually surprised at how productive those meetings were, even with Republican staffs and members.
How do you know if it's productive? Because they say they're going to do something?
They generally succeed in protecting the NEA budget from being cut. We would like more, but there was a plan this year that was suggested that could potentially get one Republican and one Democratic member to support and to write some op-eds for, to, instead of getting a yearly budget on that, propose a larger amount of money to be played out over 5 years. So it was really cool. And Tim Daly's a really smart guy, and was fun to watch him run those meetings.
And it's his, he put the coalition together?
No, I think it was originally put together by Alec Baldwin, Susan Sarandon, and Christopher Reeve in the late 80s during the initial
So this is
NEA
something that happens
scandal.
Every year?
Every year. It's in the lead up to the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner, or weekend. It's, you know, that's when everybody's coming to Washington to lobby members of Congress for various reasons. So they like to come in with a big group and make an impression.
And you were there?
I was there, yeah.
And Constance was there?
She was, yeah.
And how did they reach out to you? Is it just
I'm not sure. I think they reached out to my publicist, or my publicist reached out to them, because I'm a big nerd about Washington stuff. But
you are?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a studio teacher really early on during the Clinton Dole campaign in 96 who had me studying the presidents and the electoral process and everything, and it's always been something I've been interested in. Yeah.
And are you fascinated with politics?
Yes, depressed often with it, but fascinated
with
it.
Big fan of the democratic system, the idea of it functioning.
Maybe not so much the electoral college and the district drawing that we have all over the country, but yeah.
There's some tricky shit going on.
There's some, and Citizens United has been a real sour development in our process too. So, I don't know, it's tough, but yeah, I mean, going back to, I just watched that the Roosevelts, that Ken Burns thing, watched all 12 hours of that.
It's pretty fascinating. So, right?
It is, yeah. Yeah, he was amazing. They all were amazing, Eleanor and Teddy, too.
Yeah, and they were, but they come from the upper crust.
Yeah.
It's interesting that there were presidents, you know, George, the Bushes, too, like the second Bush, like you, these complete privileged people. And but, you know, the Roosevelts, at least, seem to their legacy seems to be noble.
Yeah, and that Franklin's disability made this change in him where he genuinely wanted to engage with, you know, people suffering. And his, I think it's in Warm Springs, Georgia, where he'd have the polio center with, you know, kids that were disabled and everything. And yeah, just yeah, that kind of mixture of that guilty conscience from coming, you know, so high up in the, you know, in the
right
or whatever.
Yeah. And also just to, you know, to like there was a time where, you know, people's affection and respect of that leader,
yeah,
of the president,
yeah,
was profound,
yeah,
and I don't think that's happened for a while.
It's yeah, we kind of like lack of, you know, we have all these terrifying problems with climate change and the Middle East and the economy and everything, and there doesn't seem to be like a national purpose. With
but
all the, this
it
thing,
just seems
know?
Like yeah. everything's become so fragmented that yeah. like you know the oh president God. Talks and you know who watches. You know, you like it, there was a time where the president yeah. was talking, the country stopped.
Yeah.
So I just think that respect for the office in general has diminished just because it's like, when was that on? When did he talk?
And that they can snipe at him on Twitter immediately.
Yeah, yeah. Just, like everybody's just lowered to the yeah. to the lowest common denominator in a way. Yeah. No one's above it.
Yeah.
Above the fray.
It's yeah, it's just an ugly. Yeah. Ugly. I heard you talk about this in a podcast recently where when it comes to like Twitter or something, if you respond to negative things, you're a jerk. And if you ignore negative things, you're aloof and terrible. And even politicians are subject to that same impossible yeah. scenario.
It's just like you shouldn't engage them.
Yeah,
but it's hard not to.
Yeah.
Now you just mute them. Just make them disappear. That's the magic of Twitter. Like they can be saying that, but I don't have to see it.
Yeah.
I just like enforced denial. Like I can magically just you know manifest my denial by not looking at that person's garbage.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's good talking to you, man.
Really nice talking to you too, man. Thanks for having me.
Haley Joel Osment, nice chat. Jerry Stahl, OG Dad, is the book. Haley Joel's movie is Entourage. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. I will be presenting a page full of new posters soon. Can you hear that hum? That's a fucking... Listen to that filth. That's dirty, dirty fuzz box. Some Earthquaker box. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.